യോന്ത പ്രവിശ്യ മമവാചമിമാം പ്രസുക്താം സഞ്ജീവയതി അഖിലശക്തിധരസ്വധാംന അന്യാംശ്ച ഹസ്തചരണശ്രവണത്വകാലീൻ പ്രാണാന് നമോ ഭഗവതേ പുരുഷായ തുഭ്യം. ലെറ്റ് അസ് നൗ മെഡിറ്റേറ്റ് ഫോർ എ ഫ്യൂ മിനിറ്റ്സ് ഓൺ ദ സുപ്രീം റിയാലിറ്റി വിച്ച് എനർജൈസസ് ദ എൻ്റെ ക്രിയേഷൻ ആസ് ഇറ്റ്സ് ഇൻഡ്വെല്ലർ. ഓം പീസ് പീസ് പീസ്. നൗ അവർ സബ്ജക്റ്റ് ഈസ് ഭഗവത്ഗീത and we are planning to deal with the two chapters, the 12th and the 15th. Most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the text, at least some portions of the text. There could be still every year, there may be just a few newcomers. For their sake, I just give a brief introduction to the text as a whole and the place it occupies in world thoughts or in world spiritual heritage. Bhagavad Gita is a tiny fraction of the famous classic of ancient India, Mahabharata. Mahabharata contains 100,000 verses. 200,000 lines. That is the shortest version. There are three different versions. The largest version contains 1 lakh, that means 145,000 verses. 145,000 verses. That would be something like 9 or 10 times the size of Homer's Iliad and Virgil's Aeneid put together, the two great classics of ancient Greece. And this text, Bhagavad Gita, contains only 700 verses. So you can imagine, it's a very tiny fraction of the huge classic. It contains 18 chapters. It is in the form of a dialogue between a great spiritual personality of ancient times, Lord Sri Krishna, who is supposed to be an incarnation of God Himself. That is how the traditional Vedantins look upon Him. And it's a dialogue between Sri Krishna and a soldier, a famous soldier of ancient times, Arjuna. Now, if you read the background of this text, you will find this dialogue was taking place. It took place in a battlefield. But this battlefield is just an coincidence. It doesn't have anything at all to do with war or battle. A few clarifications are required because there have been many misunderstandings. Not now, but in the 19th centuries and the early 20th centuries, a number of books were written about Gita, very often misrepresenting the actual background of the text. As I said, it's a dialogue between a great spiritual teacher of ancient times and a great warrior, Arjuna. The battle took place somewhere near Delhi, about 50 miles northwest of India's capital, Delhi. Now, the background is this. There was an ancient dynasty with two branches. The younger brothers, five children, and the elder brothers, 100 children. Two groups, they fought a battle. It so happened that the the children of the elder brother took away all the wealth, all the properties of the children of the younger brother, Pandavas. The children of younger brothers were called Pandavas. And Arjuna is one of the five brothers. And it so happened that they not only took away their wealth, they took away their kingdom, they tried to molest the wife of one of the Pandava princes, tried to kill them twice by poisoning and also by setting fire to their home. And ultimately Lord Krishna, who is the teacher of Bhagavad Gita, made an elaborate effort to bring them into some kind of a reconciliation, to avoid. He was a great negotiator. So he himself went to the Kaurava court, the branch of the elder brother, the Kauravas, who took away the wealth and property of the children of the younger brother. And then he tried to convince them, well, you are children of two brothers, half the kingdom belongs to the younger brother and the other half belongs to the elder brother. If you are not willing to part with half the kingdom, you at least give them five villages. That also they refused. They refused to divide the kingdom into two halves, and they also refused to even hand over five villages for Pandavas. Then Lord Krishna said, well, at least give them one big house where all of them can stay together. And the rest of the country, keep palace, everything may belong to you. That also this Kauravas refused. And along with that, they even tried to set fire to the small hut where they were staying and tried to poison them and sent assassins to kill them and tried to molest their wife, Pandava brothers. So Krishna had no other way. He had to support the younger brother. Younger brother had died earlier, but he sees five children. That Yudhishthira, Bhima, Arjuna, Nakula, and Sahadeva. Arjuna comes, he comes in the middle. So they were ready for this battle. They have assembled. Why I'm narrating this incident? Very often Gita is portrayed as a book in which the teacher asks the disciple to fight. This interpretation is there. That is very much misplaced. If you can think of robbers breaking into a village and the policemen who are supposed to defend the villagers to fight with the robbers, if they say, well, we should not fight with the robbers, they are good people, we should not shed their blood, so let them take away our wife, children, mothers, wealth, everything, set fire to houses, let us run away from here. If somebody tells like that, God will not take their side. So here, Arjuna was facing such a predicament. Though he was known as a famous warrior in ancient times, he became terribly confused and perplexed, and he didn't know what to do because he had to fight with many of his cousins who had taken the other side. Arjuna was not a man of wisdom. If you look at the Gita, the first chapter, you find Arjuna was not a man of wisdom. Arjuna was a terribly confused man. Many of us face critical situations in life, dilemmas, crisis. We don't know what to do. Perhaps we know what to do, but because our action involves some unpleasant experiences, it's a bit difficult to do. Then we run away and then we try to give justification for our inaction, laziness and lethargy. That's what Arjuna is doing in the first chapter. If you read the first chapter, you understand. Arjuna had come to the battlefield, ready to fight. So it's clear, it shows that he was not a man of renunciation like Buddha was. But he speaks the language of the man of renunciation. Why? Because he was a bit afraid to fight at that time, because there were far greater soldiers on the other side. So he says, well, I don't want victory. We should not fight with these people. I shall give one sloka. Nakamkshe vijayam krishna nacha rajyam sukhanija kimno rajena govinda kim bhogeihi jivitenava. Arjuna says, well, I don't want victory. I don't want kingdom, anything. I can rather remain a mendicant. He says that. Guru nakatvahi mahanubhavan shreyo bhoktum paikshum api ihaloke hatvartha kamamstu guru nihaiva bhunjiya bhogan dhridhara pratigdhan. So translation is this. We should not fight these people. And who are the type of people? Arjuna himself calls them hardcore criminals. I should tell, I should give the sloka. And then he says, well, let us know, I am not ready to fight with them. Let them take away everything. I shall remain a beggar. I will somehow subsist on begging. Sri Krishna calls him a hypocrite. If a Buddha comes to Sri Krishna and tells him, or Gandhi for that matter, well, I am not willing to fight, Krishna would have congratulated them. But here Arjuna is a soldier. He come to the battlefield armed to the teeth. And when he faced a crisis, he was reluctant to do that. He doesn't tell Krishna, well, I'm afraid, I'm not willing to fight. He says, well, what's the use of fighting? So Krishna could see through the game. And Krishna calls him Mithyachara Saucheda. You are a hypocrite. That's what Krishna tells you. Look, Arjuna himself understood that it was his duty to fight. So policeman's duty is to fight the criminals who are trying to molest women folk or rob innocent people or kill innocent children. If a policeman says, well, these are all hard criminals, we should not fight with them. If we fight with them, we'll become sinners, we'll be incurring sins. Then those policemen are not fit for their profession. Now here Arjuna tells the same thing. In the first chapter you find Arjuna tells Sri Krishna, he says, Nihatya dhatrashtranna ka pridisyar janardana papameva si dasman khatvedan hi adatayinaha. This is a very famous verse in the first chapter in which Arjuna tells Krishna that these fellows are hardcore criminals. Still, if I fight with them, it will be a terrible scene. In that sloka, if I nihatya, if you want to go back to the slokas, if you remember right, nihatya, you mean in the first chapter. He says, by killing these people, I will be incurring a terrible scene. And Arjuna tells, atatai, the word he uses to call these evil men who took away his wealth, his kingdom, and try to molest his wife, he calls them atatayinaha, means atatai in Sanskrit word, it means somebody who commits 5 or 6, can be interpreted both ways, crimes. First, somebody sets fire to the house, to your house, where you are staying. Somebody poisons you, agnido giridashaiva, shastrapanidhanapaha, kshetradarapakartacha, this is the definition of a hardcore criminal given in one of the most ancient texts that is called, it's a kind of code, it's a kind of constitution written around 4th century BC by a great lawgiver of ancient India. His name is Yajnavalkya. He says, Atatai is a criminal who commits any or all of the five or six criminal acts. He sets fire to your house, he poisons you, and he chases you fully armed to the teeth. And he takes away your field where you are cultivating grains for your livelihood. And he takes away your wife or molests women folk. Then what happens? He takes away all your wealth, kingdom, everything. These six crimes are committed by
these hardcore criminals. Arjuna says and he recognizes these people, these evil men, as criminals. Still he says, well, I should not fight with them. To such a man, Krishna tells, as a soldier, it is your sacred duty to fight. If Arjuna were a soldier, he would have asked him to cultivate the paddy field. If Arjuna was a farmer, and if he says, well, I'm not willing to plow the field, I'm not willing to sow the seeds, then Krishna would have asked him, it is your duty to cultivate the land. If Arjuna were a student and if he says, this examination coming, a student says, I am not willing to study. If the Krishna would have asked him, you should study and work hard and try your best to score a high mark, high grade. If Arjuna were a teacher and if he says, I am not willing to teach, Krishna would have asked him, you should teach. So, this is the context of the dialogue. Bhagavad Gita, that's why this point I want to make clear. Means Krishna tells Arjuna to do your duty. Don't run away from your duty. By running away from your duty, you cannot solve the problems of work. That's what Krishna tells Arjuna. Now coming to the subject at hand, as I said, you know, we are dealing with the 12th chapter, the very beginning. It is called Bhakti Yoga. Bhakti Yoga, we call it the path of devotion. One can approach God by whatever means is appropriate for him, appropriate for his temperament. An active man who is accustomed to do his work properly, he can turn that activism, his active habits, into a tool to reach the highest spiritual goal. If you are a musician, you can turn that music into a means, into an instrument for reaching the highest spiritual goal in your life. If you are an intellectual, then you can use those faculties to reach the highest goal in spiritual life. But if you are a man of soft temperament, who is more at home with external rituals like prayer, meditation, or worship, external worship, or reading devotional books, or singing devotional songs. Then if you have got a special talent in one of these areas, this you can turn into an instrument, into a tool, which will take you to the highest spiritual goal. In Bhakti Yoga, in the 12th chapter, we are dealing with the path of devotion. How one can reach the highest spiritual goal by channelizing, by diverting all our emotions, all our faculties towards God, giving our entire personality a Godward orientation. That's what Sri Krishna is trying to teach. I have to give you a small outline of the background of this text. Now, in the Gita, from 1st chapter to 5th chapter, you find the general science, philosophy of life is elaborately dealt with. In the 6th chapter, there is a focus on meditation. Then on the 9th chapter, and that is a very important chapter, at the end of the 9th chapter, Lord Krishna tells, Manmana bhava madbhakto madhya jimam namaskuru mamai vaishisi yuktam te pradijane priyohime. In the 9th chapter, Manmana bhava madbhakto, the meaning is this, Arjuna, you concentrate your mind on me. Manmana means your mind is going in all directions, highly distracted. Turn your mind and focus your mind on God.
In fact, this is one of the easy methods for a devotee, because mind is by its very nature extroverts. You find every minute, every moment, our mind is taking our senses towards external objects. Mind takes the ears towards sounds. It takes the nostrils towards objects which produces smell. And again, it takes the sense of touch towards objects which we perceive by touching, and it takes the sense of taste towards tasty food, and so on. So all the five senses of perception are being dragged by mind towards their external objects. That's how mind gets distracted. When we are listening to this talk, our mind, if it is not concentrated, will take our attention towards the boat that is moving in the lake. And then, when we are listening to the lake, our mind is concentrated on that sound, and at that split second, it won't be able to listen to the voice that is coming from the public address system. And this can happen at the mental level also. Even if there is no sound coming from external objects, our mind may go to a sound which we might have heard 10 years back or yesterday. Mentally you travel backward and mentally you hear sounds. That's why we are able to reproduce the sounds that we heard earlier. Music. That's why you are able to learn music, chanting, all these things. So it's a natural condition, character of the mind, to take indriyas, called senses of perception, and senses of action towards external objects. Now, Krishna tells, you try to concentrate your mind on God. This is possible. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the 12th chapter, we will discuss this subject more elaborately. So, I am not coming to that right now. So, be focused on, be a devotee of God, Manbhakta, and focus your mind on God, Manmana, and mentally try to worship me, and mentally try to pay obeisance to me. These ideas are clearly given in the 9th chapter. Now, in the 10th chapter, Lord Krishna gives an elaborate description of different aspects of God. There is a famous verse in the 10th chapter, Ahamatma Gudakesha Sarva Bhuda Syasthidaha Ahamadischa Madhyamcha Bhudanam Anta Evacha. This is the essence of the 10th chapter. Lord Krishna says, Ahamatma Gudakesha Sarva Bhuda Syasthidaha. Meaning is this, Arjuna, I am the indweller in every living being. It is I who controls, regulates, and energizes the entire creation as the indweller living in every being. I am the beginning, I am the middle, and the end of everything in this world. And then, towards the end of the 10th chapter, a very famous verse is given there. There, Lord Krishna says, wherever you find extraordinary manifestation of beauty, strength, power, nobility, sublimity, it is an expression of the Divine Spirit, who am I? Wherever you find any spark of greatness, what we call genius, not only in spiritual life, it can possibly in art, literature, in music, in poetry, in painting, in intellectual speculations, in all these, wherever
you find the manifestation of something which is sublime, which is grand and great. That grandeur, that sublimity is an expression, is a manifestation of God's glory, God's power. This idea is given in the sloka. Yadyat vibhudimat sattvam srimat urjitamevava tattadeva avagachatvam mama tejomsha sambhavam. The idea is this, wherever you find an extraordinary manifestation of beauty, grandeur, greatness, glory, any sublime quality, it is nothing but an expression of my power. It is born out of an aspect of my glory. That is a literal translation. Mama tejomsha sambhavam. It is born out of an aspect of my glory. Then Lord Krishna says, well, you can never exhaust the number of God's glories, because you cannot count them. So what Lord Krishna says is, athava bahunaitena kim jnatena bhavarjuna vishtabhyaham imam krishnam ekamshena sthido jagat. The idea is this, you cannot exhaust. What's the use of knowing one after another the different aspects of God's glory? You understand? The entire creation is built on me. I am the support of the entire creation. This is at the end of 10th chapter. So in the 10th chapter, Lord Krishna gives the different aspects, the different manifestations of the glories of the personal God. God perceived as endowed with a form, endowed with certain attributes, certain qualities and sublimities. Now in the next 11th chapter, we have a long description, elaborate description of the cosmic person, where the entire creation is equated with God. Means the entire phenomenal universe is nothing but God in visible form. And then at end of the 11th chapter, and that is very important for understanding the true significance of the 12th chapter, Bhakti Yoga, that we are going to deal with. At the end of the 11th chapter, Lord Krishna says, Bhaktiya tu ananyaya shakyaha aham evam vidhorjuna Nyadum drashtum cha tattvena praveshtum cha parantava. This is the 53rd verse of the 11th chapter. You find bhaktiya tu aninnya shakya. Well, this is my true form, the form of God as the cosmic person. Then Lord Krishna says, well, This you find in the 11th chapter, 53rd verse you find. This sublime form of God can be understood, can be properly realized, reached only through pure devotion, undiluted devotion. When our mind and all the senses of perception and senses of action are completely devoted to God, then only devotion becomes pure and perfect. And that pure devotion is the only means for a proper understanding of my true nature. This is the 53rd verse of the 11th chapter. And then in the 54th verse, that's the concluding verse, Krishna says, they'll find in the Mat Karmakrit, Mat Paramo, Mat Bhakta Sangha Varjitaha, നിർവൈര സർവഭൂതേഷു യസ്സമാമേതി സോർജുന.
ദേർ കൃഷ്ണ ടെൽസ് മത്കർമ്മകൃത്, വാട്ട് എവർ യു ഡു, ദാറ്റ് ആക്ഷൻ യു ഡിവോട്ട് ടു മീ, ദാറ്റ് ആക്ഷൻ ഷുഡ് ബി ഡിവോട്ടഡ് ടു മീ. ഡു എവറിഥിങ് വിത്ത് ദി തോട്ട് ഓഫ് ഗോഡ് ഇൻ മൈൻഡ്, മത്കർമ്മകൃത് മത് പരമം. And you should consider me as the law, as the ultimate goal. So whole life should be devoted towards the idea of God, towards the ideal of the supreme reality, and then you can reach me. This is the promise given in the 54th verse. Now in the 12th chapter, at the very beginning, Arjuna puts a question to Krishna, and this is the beginning of our subject now. Sri Krishna had already given a long discourse of different approaches to God, and Arjuna understood there are two different aspects of God. The same God, but two different approaches. One, God the impersonal, the other, God as the personal. In Sanskrit, we call Saguna, the personal aspect of God, and the Nirguna, the impersonal. Now, anybody who reads these 11 chapters will have a very natural doubt in his mind, which is the correct method, and who is a better devotee, the one who worships God with form or the one who worships God without form, the one who worships the personal or the one who worships the impersonal. If you read the gospel, you can find at the very beginning when Yam comes to Sri Ramakrishna, you find first Yam saw Sri Ramakrishna talking in his room. Then he didn't enter. He left the play, left his room and went to the temples. He attended the Aratrika. Again he came back to Sri Ramakrishna's room. And then he entered. There was another devotee, his friend and his nephew, Siddheshwar Majumdar, was with him. And remember, Yam was the man who thought of committing suicide. And that man ultimately left his home at midnight, walked around different parts of Calcutta. I won't go into those details. And somehow next day evening stumbled upon Dakshineswar temple where Sri Ramakrishna was staying. And Yam entered Sri Ramakrishna's room and had some talk. And then Sri Ramakrishna asked a question, do you worship God with form or without form? Yam said, well, I worship God without form. Now generally you find if you ask anyone, well, do you believe in God? Many people, especially the fashionable people, would say, they'd be reluctant to say, I believe in God, or I go to church or temple. They won't say, because they don't want to be known as superstitious or old-fashioned type. They would say, I don't believe in God, but I believe in a spirit. I believe in impersonal power. That's what everyone, you know, it's not that they understand what is meant by the impersonal spirit, but they want to be taken for an intellectual. They want to be mistaken as an intellectual. So there is a tendency to be, well, if I pray to God, if I worship every day, if I go to the church every Sunday, well, you have a bit superstitious old type. But I don't go to any place of worship, but I believe there is a power. No. Yam also was caught in the trap of this sort of, because Yam was, he was an admirer, he was a follower of the Brahma Samaj. And Brahma Samaj was propagating a type of God which was full of attributes, qualities, but without form. So Yam also, as any belonging to the fashionable circles of Calcutta of that time, he was himself a bit proud that he didn't go to any temple or worship
but rather he believed in some kind of impersonal reality. So that was M's reply. And then Sri Ramakrishna says, well, that is good, but then you don't think that's the only way. The other aspect also is true. That is Sri Ramakrishna's classic approach. You believe that in a God without form, all right, but don't think that's the only aspect. That those who believe in a God with form are superstitious or inferior. Don't get away with that impression. That's what Sri Ramakrishna had in mind. Anyhow, Arjuna again had this confusion. Which is the better way? And who is the superior person? Who is a more evolved devotee? The higher devotee? The one who looks upon God with form? That means somebody who looks upon God as supreme person, as depicted in the 11th chapter, the previous chapter. Or the God who is the repository of all the sublime qualities and attributes that you can think of, as depicted in the 10th chapter. That means those who look upon God as a supreme person, God who is compassionate, God who creates this world, who sustains this world, who looks after you, who listens to your prayers, and he has got all attributes, all glories, and who is the omnipotent, supreme, monotheistic God. Or the other person, the other devotee, who looks upon God as an impersonal principle, as an ultimate ideal, not necessarily endowed with form. Now, this is Arjuna's doubts. With this doubt in mind, Arjuna here asks a question to Sri Krishna. Arjuna uvacha. So, evam satata yuktayi bhaktastvam pari upasade yechapi aksharam avyaktam tesham ke yoga vittamaha. This is the question. Ke yoga means who? Yoga vittama means who is the greater devotee? Who is a greater yogi? Who is nearer to God? So, there are those who are steadfast devotees, who love you, who worship you, and who understand you as the divine person, the supreme person. Or those who contemplate on you as the supreme impersonal principle, the Advaitic ideal of Supreme Brahman, the imperishable and manifest principle. Which of these two types of devotees, which group is better? Which of these two types of devotees have got a better understanding of the true nature of God or yoga? This is the question that Arjuna puts to Krishna. Now I shall give you the Vedantic answer, the Vedanta's response to this problem. Now the classic, I would always follow the teaching as given by Sri Shankaracharya. There are different schools of thought. But this is generally considered to be the more logical approach. Now, according to Vedantic tradition, that's a tradition which belongs to Shankaracharya. According to Vedantic tradition, you can't say that those who worship God with form, those who worship God with attributes, God who creates this world, who is compassionate, who listens to your prayers, who protects you. I mean, those who worship such a God is inferior, and those who worship the impersonal principle is superior. Vedanta never agrees with this view. Vedanta says those who have not fully established in self-control, in controlling their mind, in controlling their senses, such people should look upon God as a supreme person, as a divine person. And those who are highly evolved can worship the same God in his impersonal aspects. Those who are not highly evolved, those whose mind is highly distracted by their senses, should try to divert their senses, their actions, their emotions, their feelings towards God. If you want to be proud that you are a devotee of God. If you want to work hard, work hard, and you can maybe, if you, you can achieve material prosperity, but think that it is by the grace of God. So everything is given a Godward orientation. Every aspect of our life is given a spiritual orientation. And this is very necessary for a beginner. Now, if a child, suppose a child comes to you, and I have to go to school, kindergarten perhaps. And you tell him, what do you have to study? You tell him, you have to go to kindergarten. Maybe, I don't know how it is here. In India, back home, you know, they had to memorize the fundamental arithmetic table, alphabet, 2-3 languages. And the child, it's a very terrible thing to memorize rote learning. Well, and then his brother is there. Brother may be doing research in the university, preparing his PhD thesis. Now, what does my brother do at the university? His brother, does he have to study alphabet and does he have to memorize these things? No. He doesn't have. He can sit in the library in a air-conditioned room where he can read books. Then I would rather go to the library. I would join my brother. Now, that child is never going to get any kind of education. Because the child has to evolve and reach the same status which his brother has reached. Then only he will be fit to do research work. So, those who have completely controlled their senses, those whose mind automatically, naturally goes to the transcendental reality, they need not go to any place of church, temple, or any place of worship. They need not always think of God, because they'll be always thinking of God. See, you have to accept the practice of thinking of God only if you do it 2-3 times a day. But if you are always immersed in the thought of God, then you need not be taught how to meditate, because it becomes natural to you. A PhD student doesn't need to be taught the fundamentals of alphabet or anything. It's become part of his nature. See, you find in Sri Ramakrishna's life a classic example. Sri Ramakrishna had already gone through different stages of worship of God with form. Vaishnava tradition, the Saiva tradition, all aspects of worship of God with form he had already mastered, right from his early days onwards. So he was staying in Dakshineshwar. Then the great teacher of Vedanta, the one who realized God in his impersonal form, Advaiti, Totapuri came. So Totapuri found Sri Ramakrishna was always dwelling on the transcendental plane. So he was a fit disciple who could understand the essence of Advaita. He was a most deserving, a fit disciple. So Totapuri found him the right man to learn and practice and maybe propagate Advaita. And Totapuri taught him Advaita Vedanta. I won't go into those details. But the classic example. Because Sri Ramakrishna's mind and senses were naturally drawn towards God. It was difficult for him to turn his mind towards anything other than God. That was the problem with him. For common people, to turn their mind towards God is the problem. For Sri Ramakrishna, the problem was to turn his mind away from God. To drink water, you have to turn your mind away from God. That was a problem for him. So Totabari found Siddhamakrishna as the right spirit adhigari, the right and the fit person to practice Advaita. So Vedanta tells you that if your mind naturally goes to the transcendental plane, the plane in which you realize the transitoriness of this world, if your mind is naturally drawn towards it, then you are certainly fit for looking for the worship of God in his impersonal aspects. But on the other hand, a highly distracted man, terribly confused, whose senses are always dragging him in all directions, and if he says, I believe only in a spirit, in an impersonal God, it is, in fact, it is worse than being an atheist. Because he thinks that he has reached a very high level of spiritual evolution, though he has not even started his spiritual journey. So, as an answer to this question, Sri Krishna says, because Sri Krishna understood that Arjuna was certainly not fit for worship of God in his impersonal form. Because Arjuna was a soldier. Remember, Arjuna, whom you find in the first chapter of Gita, is a man of the world. He had his own dilemma, his own problem, his own crisis. So, Krishna understood very well. So, he says, Maya Vesha Mano Yema Nitya Yukta Upasade Sardhaya Pariyo Pedaha Te Me Yukta Tamamataha. Answer is this. I consider those as most perfect in yoga, whose mind is steadily fixed on me, who is always worshipping me with all his emotions, thoughts and ideas. He is a reference to the ideal of worship of God with form. Krishna tells that I consider him as dear to me, as the real yogi who is worshipping me with his mind and his senses completely fixed on me. Sri Krishna is not saying that those who worship God with form is superior. Sri Krishna knows that Arjuna was not fit for the worship of God in his impersonal aspects. So he praises this path of devotion to convince Arjuna that this is his real path. Because if you worship God with form, and if your mind is not steady, and if your senses are highly distracted, you have one great advantage as a spiritual aspirant. You can always turn to God, whom you consider to be compassionate, merciful, your protector, the one whom you can rely upon, the one whose mercy will protect you in times of crisis. Secondly, the path of devotion, the path of worshipping God with form, involves a number of factors which keep our senses and mind and intellect occupied all the time in some kind of creative activity which takes away distraction a great deal. If you are hyperactive, well, you cannot suddenly become inactive. You cannot suddenly draw your senses from action. I'm giving an example. A man who is a workaholic, who works maybe 18 hours a day, to get promotion, and who is highly ambitious, who wants to make a good living, who wants to get a good salary and high status. You tell him the world is an illusion, money cannot give you anything, and you should try to renounce all this, because your work, your status, your increment, all these are perishable. It will be no use to you. Either he will think religion is not for me, it's for somebody else, he thinks. Because he is not fit for that. Krishna is dead against this approach. He says, Na buddhi vedan janayed ajnanam karma sanginam. Krishna tells somewhere in the Gita. See, those who are attached to work, ambitious, full of desire, who wants to achieve something solid in this life. Suddenly, if you talk about inaction, withdrawal of the senses from action, you talk to him about the transitoriness of the world. That world is a delusion or an illusion. The God is, the Subrahman is only reality. He won't understand it. So you better tell him, you work hard, you try to get a good status, but remember, once in a while, you try to read some good books, go to a place of worship, pray to God, and because a hyperactive man, a workaholic, will naturally be suffering from anxiety neurosis. There is no doubt about it. At one stage or other, a workaholic or a man obsessed with action and ambition will be a victim of anxiety neurosis. And anxiety neurosis will certainly lead to depression, because he cannot always have his goal. He cannot always expect to achieve his goal. If there is slightest problem, he will suffer from depression. So how to solve this? So you can tell him, you can go to a place of worship, you can go to some holy person and discuss Vedanta. This will be useful to him. Or he can read Bhagavad Gita or any sacred book. In this way, he can divert his attention, a part of his mind, mental energy, towards some spiritual pursuit. That will reduce his anxiety, neurosis, or depression, whatever it is. And then at a later stage, when he truly realizes, when he gets sufficient number of blows from world, and when he is forced to realize that, well, all that I worked for is perishable. It's not everlasting. Then he is the right man to think of God. And again, he has to travel long distance before he becomes fit for looking upon God as the impersonal principle. So, one advantage is you can divert your attention, your mental energies. The natural propensities of mind and intellect can be diverted, can be given a Godward orientation, a spiritual orientation. That's one advantage. Because you can always think of a God who is compassionate, who is merciful, who is ready to listen to your prayers, etc. That's why this worship of God with form has got six different stages according to the non-Advaitic school of Vedanta, the school of Ramanuja and Madhvacharya. One is, you should always try to avoid negative thoughts which take you away from your ideal of God, and try to cling fast to positive thought currents. That's why, if you are a spiritual aspirant, it is very important to keep your mind busy with good positive thoughts. If you don't deliberately try to fill your mind with positive thoughts, your mind will naturally seek negative thoughts. So the two aspects, anukulyasya sankalpaha pradikulyasya varjanam. First and second steps according to Ramanuja. One is thought of positive ideas. Filling the mind with positive thoughts. Thoughts which are conducive to spiritual life. So you should be careful about reading books, acquainting with wrong type of people who will give you wrong ideas, who might fill your mind with distractions, and who will make you more confused and more perplexed, and make your condition much worse. That's why Ramanuja says, you should try to fill your mind with positive thoughts. And then, naturally your mind will be free from negative thoughts. Pratikulyasya varjanam. Then, you have to think of God as the one who is willing to help you, protect you. Rakshasididhi vishwasaha means God is one who will protect me in times of crisis, in times of dilemmas. So one, first, you should fill your mind with positive thoughts. Second, avoid negative thoughts. Third, we have to think of God as one who will protect you. Then, you should look upon God as the one source of, as the only reliable person. So, He is the one protector and He is the only reliable person in your life. And again, you should have an aversion towards all negative thought currents which stand in the way of your spiritual progress. And then, one should mentally surrender oneself to God. If these six disciplines, so I shall chant the Sanskrit sloka and I have already explained. Anukulyasya sankalpaha pradikulyasya varjanam rakshasididhi vishwasaha goptrutta varanam tatha atmanikshepa karpanne shadvidha sharanagati. Six paths, six steps. I have already explained, so no need to explain further. So, first, filling the mind with positive thoughts, then avoiding negative thoughts, and then a strong conviction that God will protect you, and looking upon God as the only reliable person, and then an aversion towards all negative thought currents, and a sense of resignation, surrender to God's grace. These are the six steps. Now, these are very helpful in spiritual path. So that's why Sri Krishna praises those who worship God with form. Why? Because they are sure to make progress in spiritual life. So we should be very careful about the deception of the mind. Mind sometimes will tell us, well, this is a lower path. These non-Advaitic paths are inferior. I will accept only Advaita. There's a great danger in it. Advaita you can always keep in your mind as the supreme goal to be achieved. But right now, only your intellect has reached the Advaita level. When you read great Vedantic texts, there is a great danger. Our intellect has understood many of the Vedantic ideas. And then we sometimes delude ourselves into the belief that we have reached that level. It has not become an experience. Intellectually, when you read some very important Advaitic text, there are many. Ashtavakra Samhita is there, Adhyatma Ramayana is there, Gaudapada Karika. There are many important classics on Advaita, which describe God as the immanent transcendental reality. God who is not confined to a place of worship or who is not confined to a particular book. God is transcendental, immanent, omniscient, omnipresent and on. So, highly intellectually very attractive. So, many people sometimes discuss, this is wonderful. But remember, that is only intellectual perception. And a man never lives at the intellectual level. 99% of human beings live only at mental level, not intellectual level. For a fleeting moment, when we read those books, we feel that we have reached that level. But the moment we close the book, we are brought back to the level of the mind, mental level. And we mostly dwell on mental level. So, we can keep the highest ideal in mind as a goal to be aimed at, to be achieved, but not something that we have already achieved. And keeping this high goal in mind, if we divert our mind and senses and all our actions, all our emotions, all the mental energies towards a merciful, compassionate God, then we will make steady progress. This is Sri Krishna's approach, and this is the approach of Advaita also. Because why I'm stressing this point, you know, very often there is an element of self-deception in relying upon intellectual cognition alone. When there is a problem, when a serious dilemma arises, it happens at the mental level. Intellectual perception doesn't help because we listen to the dictates of the mind, not of intellect. This is a point to be understood. So that's why Krishna tells Arjuna, I consider those people who are steadfast in their devotion to me, whose minds are fixed on me. Me here means God himself, who has steadfast love for me. They are perfect. This is my considered opinion. This is what Sri Krishna tells. Because bhakti itself is often defined as incessant, endless, continuous flow of mind towards God. That is the definition of bhakti. So very often some of the scriptures define bhakti in a very classic style. You know, worldly minded people are normally attracted towards worldly objects, and they are very much focused on achieving their material goals in mind. They cannot forget them. Now, if a devotee's mind is attached to God, the way in which an ignorant man attaches himself to material things, that devotee is a real devotee. So, the kind of love and affection and obsession which a worldly-minded man has gone towards worldly objects, that kind of love and obsession a devotee should have towards God, that is the real devotion. It is a ya preeti avivekanam visheshu anapayini tum anusmaradat same hridayat ma apasarpadu. It's a famous definition of bhakti. That is a bhakti. Just as an ignorant man and without a man who has no spiritual wisdom is over attached towards material objects, worldly pursuits, too much obsessed with them. If a devotee has got the same degree of love and attachment and obsession towards God, that devotee is a real devotee. This is one definition of bhakti. Another definition is, see, if you pour oil from one pot to another pot, there is a thick flow, there will not be any gap. You know, if you pour water or any thin liquid, there will be gap. But if you pour pour oil, anything thick, there will be continuous flow. So Ramanuja says, true devotion is the continuous, unbroken flow of mental emotions towards God. And this, when this becomes natural, without any effort, if one can achieve this, or if he has become a natural character of a devotee, he is fit for the worship of God without form, the Advaita practice. That is the approach, that is the classical approach of the Vedanta. So now, next.
ఏతు అక్షరమనిర్దేశం అవ్యక్తం పర్యుపాసదే సర్వత్రం సర్వత్రగం అచింత్యం చ కూటస్థమచలం ధ్రువం సన్నియం ఇంద్రియగ్రామం సర్వత్ర సమబుద్ధేహ తే ప్రాప్నువంతి మామేవ సర్వభూత హితేరతాః.
వాట్ ఇస్ ద టైం నౌ? ఐ థింక్ 11 o'clock. సో విల్ హ్యావ్ సారీ ఐ థింక్ ఐ షుడ్ స్టాప్ 5 minutes ఎర్లియర్ విల్ హ్యావ్ ఎ డిస్కషన్ యూ కెన్ క్లారిఫై ఎనీ doubts, any points you want to raise, we can discuss now. We have got about half an hour.
You distinguished between the mental level and the intellect level.
Yes,
and
yes.
And living at those levels. I think I remember, is that part of a larger scale of levels of awareness?
Yes, you know.
What are the characteristics of
each? Well, you know, mind in Vedantic tradition is associated with impressions and emotions. Intellect, in Sanskrit, buddhi, is associated with conviction and cognition. So, for example, this can be given. If when you see an object from a distance, you are not sure what it is. You may think it is a lamppost. It may be a human being. If the light, there is not enough light, if you see an object which resembles a lamppost, you may think it's a lamppost. So when you reach the object, you understand it is a human being. Before you reach that object, before you get a conviction that it is a human being, your mind is somewhat, you have got two ideas in mind. Is a lamppost or human being? Sthanurvo, sthanurva purushova. This is Vedantic classical, because I don't want to move away from this talk examples, because these examples are being used for centuries, so they have got a fixed meaning. But when you reach that object, well, it's a human being, then your buddhi is functioning. So buddhi is a cognitive faculty, or when you make a decision, it is buddhi. But generally, when you live, you are living the world of emotions, impressions, ideas. When we take food, we don't think, is it food I am eating? We don't do that. We automatically do. So when we follow our natural habits, we are at mental level. And when you pursue something, cognize something, you are intellectual level. So what I said was, very often when we read high Vedantic text, Advaitic text, where the author says that the divinity, God is omnipresent, and we are God, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman itself, then it's a very wonderful thing, we don't have to do anything. This is a problem which may arise. In fact, this subject has been discussed many times in Vedantic text. So, well, I am Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, then what to do? I need not worry about anything. Already I am Brahman, I am God Himself. But right now, we generally think, and we are living at a mental world in which we consider ourselves to be the human body. So long as we are at the level of body consciousness, we should look upon God as God with person, as the creator of the world, of which we are a part. If you have body consciousness, then world is real, because body is part of world. The five elements, you know. And the world is real, then God is nothing but the creator of this world, sustainer of the world, protector of the world. But when we read Vedantic texts, we often read world is unreal, body, all these things are untrue. That is true. But that is only intellectual conviction, cognition. Not a matter of life experience. In fact, all spiritual practices, when you do meditate, when you pray, when you read sacred books, we are trying to bridge the gap between the mental level and intellectual level. When mental level becomes, when we merges with the intellectual level, then we really become fit for the practice of Advaita. But at the normal conditions, there is always a gap between the mental level and intellectual level. People fall in spiritual life mostly because they forget these aspects. They often remember, they often mislead themselves, they delude themselves into the belief that they have already reached that level, which is only an intellectual conviction for them, not a matter of life experience. So that's why Vedanta gives a very, very elaborate method of spiritual sadhana by reading good books, by diverting our mind to spiritual subjects, and by turning our mind more and more to spiritual ideas, we can bridge the gap between the mental level and intellectual level.
How does a person know that he's moving towards that?
In fact, every spiritual aspirant will have an inner conviction as to where he has reached. It is a kind of inner controlling system. Of course, not a beginner, but once you set upon the journey, it becomes a matter of experience. You feel that if a man is sincere and if he has got Shraddha, integrity of a very high level, he will know where he stands, what he deserves, where he belongs to. Sri Ramakrishna says, for a sincere devotee who has started his spiritual journey, mind becomes his guru. Very often it happens. That's the sense in which Sri Ramakrishna uses this term. Yes, and Krishna tells in the 11th chapter, mat karma krit. The meaning is, whatever you do, think it is my work. Whatever you do, it's my work. This one approach. This is elaborately explained from 8th to 11th verse. In the same chapter that we are going to deal with. From 8th verse to 11th verse. ഫലത്യാഗം. There are four levels of spiritual progress explained in these four verses, 8th, 9th, 10th and 11th, in a descending order. We will discuss this point. Sri Krishna says, for a beginner whose mind is distracted, he can do his duty in whatever way it is possible for him, and then mentally surrender, resign the results of his action to God. You are making me doing all this, I surrender to you. If the man is sincere, then it becomes a royal high road for him, that will take him to the highest Advaitic experience. Explain the 8th verse. That is a very 8th, from 8 to 11, you will deal with that subject. So Sri Krishna says, for a spiritually unevolved person, who has not moved one inch in his spiritual life, he can begin his spiritual journey. Who cannot keep his mind and intellect in God, that's the 8th verse, or who cannot practice spiritual sadhana, that is in the 9th verse, or who cannot live as a karma yogi in the 10th verse. So if you cannot practice any of these paths, still you can begin your spiritual journey. Whatever you do after doing, well, surrender to God. Slowly, if this is done sincerely, it will take you to higher and higher level. Ultimately, it will take you to the highest position of a devotee, that is explained in the 8th verse. I will come to this later. Now we need not time.
Swami, how does one discriminate between that which is good and that which is not good?
I mean, personal or impersonal?
Without using negative, positive qualities. You say to stay away from negativity.
Yeah, yes.
But to discriminate, one has to see the difference. Like Arjuna had to see criminal acts as something that works.
Yes. Now, Gita says, anything which takes your mind away from spiritual thoughts, which takes your mind away from tranquility, from serenity, that is negative. Anything which gives you a feeling of integrity, serenity, natural calmness and tranquility, that is positive. Very often, you know, confusion is the greatest problem for the mind. Not doubt, but confusion. Confusion is a great problem. When you are terribly confused, then we cannot move in either direction. So, anything which reduces confusion, which gives mind a degree of integrity and serenity and calmness, that is positive. That is the touchstone, that is the criterion given to Vedantic text.
Earlier you mentioned the 6 points that you differentiate between negative thoughts and aversion towards negative currents. Would you mean
aversion towards
negative currents?
That is pratikulyasya varjanam, you know. The point is, yes, that is 5th and 6th, atma niksheba karpanne, you know. Actually, karpanya means aversion. Anything which creates confusion mind, takes your mind away from positive and turns your mind towards negative. If you should have a sense of aversion, then only you can avoid it. These are all interrelated. These are not separate completely one from the other. These are all interrelated. And if one who is fully established in one of the 6 becomes naturally established in all the other 5 as well. This is what.
Would you repeat that, Swami?
Hmm?
Would you repeat that, please, what you just said?
Hey?
Would you please repeat what
Yes. One is, the first step is always have try to fill the mind with positive attitudes. Second, and simultaneously try to avoid negative attitudes. Negative attitude means sometimes mind will tell, oh well, it is not possible, it's difficult, and or by wrong association sometimes, you know, our mind will become skeptical. Doubts may arise, skepticism will arise. This should be avoided. And then a strong conviction that God will protect us. God's ability and willingness to protect us is trust. 4th one is looking upon God as the only reliable one who will protect us in all conditions. There is no other agency who can save us from dilemmas. And then a sense of self-surrender, resignation to God's will and grace. 6th one is an aversion towards anything which takes your mind away from this path. Many negative thoughts, aversion, strong aversion, because a strong aversion towards negative, undesirable thought currents is a great help in spiritual life. Undesirable, I am using terms, you know, but the one, anything which is unspiritual, which is unethical, which will take our mind away from God. Yes, if one reaches the perfection in one of these, you will naturally be reached. Because perfection is possible only if you master all these four.
Because you can completely avoid negative thoughts only if you can completely fill your mind with positive thoughts. And this is possible only if you look upon God as the only protector, as the only reliable person. And all this is possible if you have only if you have got a strong aversion towards the unspiritual, anything which is opposed to our spiritual life. Natural aversion. This is the all, after all, you know, we are all turned to Vedanta because we have a natural aversion towards blind, towards the worldly pursuits. Not that people completely get away from it, but at least even a little interest in Vedanta is not possible unless we have a little aversion towards worldly things.
So how do we look upon things like crime and war and the things of the world that are, say, negative actions? How do you look upon those?
Well, you know, we need not bother about them. You bother only about positive thoughts. You see, to move away from negative, you need not worry about negative. You should only worry about the positive. If you want to move away from the east, well, I want to go away from the east, and then if you move towards the south or north, you may not necessarily move away from the east. The only way to move away from the east is to move towards the west. That is the spiritual.
To have the conviction that God will always protect us, right? That comes at a very also high level of realization. Otherwise, yeah. You know, if we completely depend on that, then, you know, we have to also depend on the policeman and the other and our good senses to avoid the bad, right? So that self-effort has to be there.
In fact, you know, all these are there. In Sanskrit called Siddha level, Sadhana level. When you practice to acquire these qualities, that's one level. When you have become fully established in these qualities, that's another level. So when you try to acquire them, you will slowly start moving towards the west. And to that extent, you will be moving slowly away from the east. So it is not something that happens all of a sudden. Gradual.
And this aversion which you talked about also depends on the level of evolution of that test.
Yes.
And also some of it is acquired and developed.
Right. In fact, without a degree of aversion towards worldly things, one cannot take even an intellectual interest in Vedanta. At least it is a sincere desire to know and go deeper into Vedantic ideas is possible only if you have a little aversion towards other worldly things. Now, all great Vedantic students are refugees from the world itself, worldliness. They want to get away, they want to go beyond this. They want to seek something transcendental which goes beyond all this. That's why, beyond the empirical, the phenomenal. Just a few minutes, I think, we have to conclude at 11:30.
I'm not sure if I've got the right words for this question, but in what you just said about a Vedantic student needs to feel aversion for the world, and then you also said aversion to worldliness. That seems like an important distinction because.
I really mean, when I said aversion towards the world, I really mean worldliness, in fact. I mean aversion towards the idea that empirical worldly pleasures are only things to be sought after.
Yes.
An aversion towards that philosophy of life, kind of. That's what I am. Not world, phenomenal world in which we are living. Not that's not. Worldliness is an attitude towards life. That's what I mean. Om Shanti 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 Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.